For a remote company, one of our principles is to make the work that's happening and the progress for that work visible. For people to see that there's activity happening around you fosters a feeling of camaraderie and velocity.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host. Let's get to the real work. Hey everyone, today we're speaking with Sumeet Jain, who is the head of engineering at Sublime Security. Sumeet has 20 plus years of development experience, notably including stints at Stripe and Box before joining Sublime. And Sumeet and the team at Sublime actually have a very particular way of working, which I'm super excited to unpack in today's conversation. We're going to dig into how Sublime structures their engineering work, including the why behind their one-week cycles. We'll talk about their unconventional approach to tooling and how Slack and Notion alone do most of the work across the team. And so, Sumeet, we're really excited to have you on today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I wanted to touch on something because you studied philosophy in university well before boot camps made that a common major to lead into engineering. I was wondering, when did you catch the software bug?
I started coding in middle school. I made a tribute page to my favorite basketball player, Penny Hardaway. I think it was a time when everybody was getting like a tripod site or a GeoCities site, something just fun to make a mark on the internet, Wild West as it was. And then that snowballed into learning different types of development, different parts of the stack. And it wasn't supposed to be a career necessarily. It was just a hobby. And it was, I think coincidental that I was interested in studying philosophy. I never wanted to be a developer, I wanted to be a teacher. So for me, philosophy was my pathway to that.
Very cool. Today, obviously, you run engineering at Sublime. Could you give us the breakdown of your team size, the composition, the company stage to help orient?
Sublime Security, we help organizations protect the inboxes of the people who work at that organization. So we're an email security platform and Series B company, about 20 people overall in engineering. Myself, two engineering managers, and 16 or 17 engineers.
Where's the team located? How are folks distributed geographically?
We're a fully remote company. We don't have an official office, but everybody who works here is based in North America. All of the engineering team is in the United States, but within the US, we're spread really coast to coast, not just the coasts, I should say. So we've got a lot of folks in Denver, some folks in Texas. There are still times when somebody's up early or somebody's up late and there's nobody else around, but that's something that we haven't had too much trouble adjusting to. But West Coast to East Coast is really the start and end of it for us right now.
I want to dig in some meat on how the work actually gets done. Most teams follow two-week sprints, right? It's kind of like the typical way an engineering team is structured. ShapeUp out of 37 signals has gained a little bit of popularity, so that 6 to 8 week stick is more and more common. You've gone in the opposite direction with 1 week cycles. And so I want to talk a little bit more about those details and really understand your point of view on this. So what does the typical development cycle look like at Sublime Security?
I should say that the decision to have a 1 week cycle predates me. That's not something that I brought into the company. It's something that the founders and the first engineer who joined the company began working in this way. Personally, I enjoy it. I think there are times when I don't enjoy it as much. It can be a lot of work to do that kind of planning motion on a one-week cadence. But it predates me, and the cycle itself is not that different than planning a sprint or any other type of planning cycle that you might have. And it's important to be clear, we plan in one-week cycles. And that means that work and units of delivery are also within that week. But that doesn't mean that all work is completed within the scope of a week. There's going to be stuff that has to go far beyond that. But the reason that we operate this way is because at our size, being hyper-responsive to the evolving needs of the business helps us maintain a competitive advantage. It's joyous to be able to hear something from a customer and within just a couple of days have something turned around that delights them. It's often critical to learn something new about the landscape in front of you and shift priorities instead of having to wait 7.5, 9 days until the next time when priorities are reevaluated. So in theory, you can shift gears at any time, but in practice, when you're in the midst of sometimes chaotic, intense work, it can be very difficult to get all of the necessary parties aligned on changing a priority. So kind of like a forcing function to just reevaluate on a weekly cadence, we make sure that there's time set aside for the plan. And then that exists as a 1 week artifact.
Basically, if you have the muscle of every week deciding what is the most important thing, you're always in a position for the most important thing to change. Or you're in the position once a week for that most important thing to change, which allows you to be super responsive. I like that a lot. I interviewed Kent Beck for the show, and he talked about this being his preferred way of working as well for pretty similar reasons. It allows you to get a lot closer to the customer. And being an early stage company, that can be a huge advantage. I want to better understand what a day or the week actually looks like for yourself and folks on the team so that I can conceptualize this a little bit more clearly. Could you just describe what like Monday through Friday looks like as specifically as it makes sense to share?
On Monday, we'll start a Monday morning. That's the last day of the planning cycle. That Monday morning, myself, a number of other people are on a call together where we're reviewing everything we've learned about the business since the week prior. We might hear from our head of customer success about new escalations for our current customers, feature requests that we should be giving more urgency to. We might hear from our head of detection engineering on things that are necessary to augment in our platform so that we can provide new detection capabilities to customers. Product managers, the founders are all in this call, and together we're deciding what makes sense to prioritize for the week ahead. That's also a time for us to zoom out, think about broader context that we want to share with the company, just as part of the all hands. That process wraps up on Monday while engineers themselves are completing the final day of whatever their work was. Maybe they're getting things pushed to production if they need to be, or merging things that they just finished up. If they're working on several tasks, it's just whatever they can get done on that last task that they were in the middle of. Tuesday morning begins with an all-company meeting. We review the priorities for the company and any new context around deals that we've closed or places that we want to make sure that as a company we're aligned on everybody having the same vantage point. That's a half hour. And when all hands is completed, we consider the next cycle kicked off and everybody has a new week's worth of a docket to work from. Daily, at that point, at our size and the way that we operate, a lot of our work is not given a detailed PRD before an engineer begins on it. A lot of it is, here's a problem. We have some clarity of it. We have a sense of which customers need this more urgently than others. Let's figure out what to do about it. So the daily work cycle itself is hop on a call with one or two people as needed to figure out what to do next, put together some sort of a design for what you're going to be building, build it, ship it as possible. If there's a small iteration, for example, if we know that the broad release of something is going to take us 3 or 4 weeks, but we know that one customer desperately needs a piece of this urgently, ship that small piece while you're getting feedback from the customer, keep iterating on the larger delivery. There's a workflow that usually happens on a Thursday or a Friday, which is that we will start to think ahead about what we want to take into that planning meeting on Monday. So that's more for the stakeholders and organizers of work to be zooming out, thinking about what else has come into their purview and how the work that we already took on, how that's going. It's only been a couple of days, but are we on track to finish those things or do we want to make sure to carry those over?
Your week, for all intents and purposes, is Tuesday to Monday, where Monday is the last day of any given cycle. And on that last day, it sounds like yourself, the product managers, and the founders, they get together, or you get together, and review everything that could be perceived as a useful input for the next cycle of work. And it sounds like that's a live conversation between that core group of people. Is there a set process for collecting that information ahead of time so that you're working from something consistent each week?
Yeah, it gets into the tooling a little bit. We operate as a company almost entirely on Notion. We use Slack for our chat application, and then Notion is really the source of truth, and record keeping coordination work is happening in Notion. So we have a template, or rather a database in Notion called Weekly Plans. And every week we create a new document in that database, and it has a template that we follow where there are tables of work that was, for example, kicked out of previous planning cycles. So we want to make sure that if we have at any point we decided not to do something, let's make sure it doesn't slip through the cracks. Every task that exists in our task management system, which is also Notion, has a button that you can click that says review in planning. And so that template that we look at every week has a table which simply shows you any task where that button has been clicked in the last 7 days. There's lots of ways to create input into the planning cycle, and then those are all consolidated into that page. And what we're effectively doing as a part of this planning process is reviewing that inventory slowly, manually, with some good discussion about what's important and what's not, and making hard decisions. And then that's what we take into the planning meeting.
So you've built a system in Notion that allows you to easily dump things in a single click into the weekly plans database, which allows you to review it really seamlessly in that Monday meeting with a live call. How long does that last usually?
It usually lasts somewhere between 30 to 90 minutes. It's okay. Scheduled for an hour, and usually we'll either end it early and a couple people will go off into a separate room to chat about something that goes a little bit deeper offline. Sometimes we find that it's really just a bunch of async work that needs to conclude over the course of the next day, so we end it early, but on average, about an hour.
You kept referring back to customer requests, and it sounds as if customer input, bugs, feature requests, what have you, is a huge driver of what gets prioritized for you. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Generally speaking, we know that if there's something which helps a customer today, it's going to help customers that we haven't signed yet. So we put a lot of weight into anything that an existing customer is saying would help them in their workflow. And so if a customer requests a feature, certainly we want that to be considered. If a customer reports a bug, or if a customer runs into some other type of issue, we really do want to fix that with urgency, partly because it prevents the backlog from just getting too big and spilling over, but partly because we know that that's an investment in the next customer as well. So for us, as a company that's trying to scale up rapidly and we have these aspirations and ambitions, we know that those investments today will have compounded value in the future.
Playing devil's advocate on the process, I think I've already revealed that 1 week cycles are attractive to me personally, but I do wonder how much additional overhead is created by this. You yourself at the beginning of this said, yeah, I mean, it is a lot of work and it did predate me. And so does it feel worth it to you?
Right now it does. We're growing. And so I think there's a question mark around how coordination headwinds that we are only beginning to come up against are going to push us to evolve. The reason it feels worth it to me right now is because we have, at least I'll say that my personal take on the value of the 1 week cycle is that I tend to think the opposite of the typical under promise and over deliver mentality. I really like the idea of, I wouldn't say exactly over-promise and under-deliver, but I like the idea of people being ambitious and thinking, I absolutely, if I put focus and urgency behind this type of work, I can do something quickly. I can simplify the work and help a customer achieve some value rapidly. And we've heard that from so many of our customers that it's reinforced our belief in this idea. But the danger with operating from a sense of add more buffer to the timeline under promise and over deliver is that it can create, I don't think this is always true necessarily, no system is perfect, but I worry that it can create a sense of complacency and safety that makes people feel a little bit less ambitious. And so the 1 week cycles felt worth it to me because it pushes that way of thinking to the forefront. Can we do something any sooner? If you aren't able to get something done this week, knowing that we're going to be reevaluating priorities next week, there's a chance that you won't even get an opportunity to finish what you started. We might decide that the window for that opportunity has passed and there's something else that demands your attention. And so there's a motivation that's created to get things done. But at the same time, we don't want people staying up until 3 in the morning every day. So there's also a motivation to be judicious about what we put into the plan and to collaborate with the team to make sure that what we're doing doesn't betray their trust in us. It's not enough to just say, can you go faster, be more ambitious? You also need to do that in a way that starts to make sense and if needed, also coach people on how they can take what would have otherwise felt like a four-week minimal ship and break it down into pieces so that there actually is value that you can provide within a week. So it feels worth it to me right now. But the other piece that I'll say is that you can't just decide to have a one-week process and say, all we've done is change a number. All we've done is change the number of weeks from 2 to 1 or from 6 to 1 or whatever to 1. You have to acknowledge that doing that demands an investment in the process and operations and culture around that. And so one of the things that has helped is that we've invested a lot in how we operate and how tasks, projects are managed so that this can be a slightly more cost-effective way of planning work.
This is the perfect segue to talk about the process operations and the tooling stuff that I really want to talk to you about, but I'm not going to take it because there was one thing that you said I am just endlessly curious about, which is the fact that you've hinted at if the work's not done at the end of day Monday, it very well may be the chance that, you know, it is no longer permitted to be worked on, at least in the short term. And so what happens in a world where the cycle ends and the work's not finished? It's not in a state that can be shipped.
99% of the time, it just carries over and we keep working on it until it's finished. But there are cases, there have been cases where there was, let's say, a customer that would have, that we would have been able to have a better job, to do a better job onboarding a customer if only this one change to the onboarding process were implemented. We aren't able to get it done in time. That window's passed. We signed the customer anyways. It was just a rockier process. And then move forward. And if the code for something like that is not nearly complete, but if it's like halfway done, sometimes, at least in our way of working, it's better to move people to some other part of the business that we can capitalize an opportunity on. So it does happen. I don't think that that happens often enough that it's really front and center for folks when they're doing their work. It's more that the 1 week cycle is important because it's not just about asking yourself, what is new that we want to work on? It's also a matter of what are we working on that we might want to reevaluate its importance, or if we have uncovered new complexity that changes the effort that's going to be required to ship something, has that now created misalignment with our appetite for that work being completed? So for the value that we were hoping to get out of something, we might have expected it to take this long and it was worth it in that world. But now that we understand more about it, maybe it's not worth it. And we would like to avoid the sunk cost fallacy and shift gears to something higher leverage.
Yeah. So it sounds like the muscle is really about reassessing priorities once a week and less about making sure that every unit of work can fit into a 1 week period of time.
Yes. They're related because a unit of work that can't fit into one week's measurement is given a lot of scrutiny to see if it's not being broken down enough. But you're right. The crux of this is not make work as small as possible. The crux of this is focus on what's most important right now. And that question loses relevance the longer it takes to ask it. And so that's why we've moved it to 1 week.
All right, so we've got this picture of how the work itself gets done. How do you think about the process, culture, and operations that are necessary to enable an effective one-week cycle?
The tools and processes perhaps work at any cadence for planning. I think that our compression of the planning cycle makes them maybe more necessary. So I don't think that these things are necessarily specific to a one-week cycle. But as an example, some of the principles that we think about with our operations are try to unify the tools that are being used as much as possible. Fewer different services or applications to check to understand work is better. Less context switching, more unification of data. Try to implement process in the place where the work is already happening, as opposed to a new system or a new service to bolster a process, just get it into the system that's already doing the work. For us, that means building a lot into Slack, because that's really where work happens. Even if Notion is our tool for task management and task tracking, once a task has been kicked off, so much happens in Slack, especially for a remote company, that if you ask any member of the team to do substantial work outside of Slack, you have to have a really solid justification for it. Our engineers use an IDE for writing code, but that's because there's just no conceivable way to do that within Slack. So like, we would never suggest that. But something like managing and understanding feature flags is something which we actually have invested in, moving some of that work into Slack, so that as work is happening, engineers don't need to go to the browser outside of Slack, go to a different site that maybe they're no longer logged into, search in that site's interface, because that site doesn't have the context of Slack channels, which might be used to organize work, find the feature flag that they care about, and then use that interface. Instead, can we move any of that into Slack? So moving it into the place where the work is already happening helps people maintain flow. Especially for a remote company, one of our principles is to make the work that's happening and the progress for that work visible. And so as activity is happening, especially since people aren't sitting in the same row of desks or cubicles, for people to see that there's activity happening around you fosters a feeling of camaraderie and velocity. And so doing some things to help that work feel visible is another area we've invested in.
So the three core things I've heard you say is, one, unify the tools, fewer services, fewer places to check, et cetera, et cetera. Two, implement the process where the work is already happening. And so, you know, almost everything sounds like it's out of Slack and Notion. Exceptions apply, but only when absolutely necessary, and then make the work visible. You provided an example of how you're using Slack to even manage feature flags in some cases, which I think is pretty interesting. Can you share another example of maybe an unconventional way that you're using Slack to keep folks in a singular space rather than going out to a point solution that many other folks might normally rely on?
Yeah, I think it's probably becoming more common to use Slack in this way. I think we were maybe a little bit early, but I'll share it in case folks aren't aware. To set context, we're a fully remote company, as I've mentioned. A lot of the conversations about work are happening in Slack, but we use Notion to track tasks. One example is a customer makes a request and we talk directly to our customers inside of Slack. We have Slack Connect channels with each of them. In the context of that thread, it's clear we need to do something, invest in a feature, fix a bug, whatever. That conversation is likely to be forgotten about or missed as part of our planning process if we don't immediately make a task and capture the necessary context from it. In my experience supporting teams, I have found there's friction even in titling a task. So if I were to tell somebody who's in that thread, I love that you have a thread, it's 75 messages long, can you please just go to Jira or whatever and make a ticket? Of course, we use Notion. Can you go to Notion and make a task? I have experience that tells me one of the friction points for that is simply the cognitive load of figuring out what to title the task. And then there's cognitive load for how to summarize the thread. There's also cognitive load, not exactly cognitive load, but some friction in leaving Slack, going to Notion or whatever other tool, and using that tool's interface to create the ticket or task or whatever the item might be. And so what we do is an emoji reaction to a message in that thread kicks off a workflow which will summarize the thread's contents, come up with an 80-character max title, tag it as a bug or feature request or whatever else is relevant, and assign the person who used the reaction, and then kick that over to Notion so that it is now an actual task assigned to that person. It has what we're finding really well-crafted title and a really great summary as well, so that anybody else who's coming in can see that task. And this is at this point, this is so useful and such an ergonomic way to create tasks that at least for engineers, very few people are actually creating tasks in Notion at all anymore. Even if there's no conversation, there are just comments and messages in random Slack channels where somebody will type out what they want to do and they'll say, just sharing this for the task. And then they'll immediately emoji react their own message because that's a faster way for them to create the task than it would have been to go to Notion and do the exact same thing. And so part of this is just, again, they're doing a bunch of work in Slack, bouncing around from one channel to the next. And as they're doing it, emoji, emoji, emoji here and there, and the task gets created.
Wow, that's so cool. So let me make sure I understood that right. So basically, maybe the conversation with the customer, maybe it's a conversation between folks, happens in Slack, you hit it with a particular emoji that presumably triggers some sort of workflow in Zapier or something that brings it over to an LLM that summarizes the content of that Slack. It creates a description of the ticket or the task for Notion. It creates a title. It populates all of that information for you. And what you're finding is it's doing it well. And then that's all captured in the task management bit. That's cool.
Just to add to it briefly for you, like there's a lot that you can do once you have kicked it over to Zapier and you've got like some sort of LLM working on it. For instance, we just recently, a few months ago, hired our first EMs besides me. And that raises a question of who owns this task. Before that, it was always just, well, I do. I'll figure out who to assign it to. But there was still a question of which engineer knows the most about this thing that we've now auto-generated a task for. We have in Notion a database of all of the various domains, services, features, which engineer has worked on those domains or services or features or whatever, and which manager then has that in their overall purview. And so that database is basically converted into JSON and fed into the LLM prompt so that in addition to assigning an owner for the task, it also is tagged with a domain that helps you affiliate it with an engineering manager's overall area of responsibility. So if a task isn't going to be worked on today or next week, but we still want to track it, there's longitudinal tracking across planning cycles. So an engineering manager can say, let me just look at all of the tasks that have been created via support requests from customers over the last 6 months that relate to this domain or this service. So there's a lot of fun you can have with improving operations there as well.
Is the domain model being updated as new people work on new tasks automatically?
It could be better. It's not automatic. And so the individual manager owns the part of that domain's database that they're overall responsible for. So there's definitely a latency that comes from that. But anybody can update it. We've had people who are speaking to customers and their support representatives for our company, they'll update it. If an engineer hops into a thread to help with an escalated customer support request and the support person finds that, oh, turns out Maddie is actually an expert at this as well, I wasn't tracking that, let me just add Maddie to that cell in the column so that next time I'll know that I can reach out to her.
Got it. So what it doesn't have is like the history of every task that anybody's ever worked on and the contents of all of that and using that as input. It is a manually updated thing, but because anybody is empowered to update it, it ends up being reasonably up to date and accurate.
Yeah, that's right. I'd love to describe the end to end for how a particular task or project goes. Because we've talked about planning and we might say, okay, great. As part of the plan, let's build this feature. So now what? What we've found is that that feature definitely needs its own Slack channel. And so we'll kick off a Slack channel to work on that feature. But what the work is at this stage is probably the engineer who's assigned to it, a product manager, probably one of the founders, hopping on a call together and jamming on what they would like to see for V1 of that and how they might break that into milestones. And so that channel, we call them T channels. I created the first T channel at the company, and when somebody asked me what the T stood for, I told them that at the time, it was either task or topic or temporary, and so I just went with T because it fit everything, but the truth is these are meant to be temporary channels where you're discussing one particular task, and when that task is done, you archive the channel. And so you create a T channel for organizing the work, and that way it keeps noise out of the overall engineering channel or the overall product channel. And then a lot of stuff is wired up into that now as well. So as you use the emoji to create tasks, if that emoji is used inside of a T channel, you will be able to find in Notion a parent task that is associated with that T channel. And the task that you've just created will automatically be marked as a subtask of that parent task. So as we're working on something, we'll find new scope. We'll find new things to keep an eye on. We'll find new needs for spikes. And most of the time, we're finding those things through the conversation in Slack. And so instead of it being lost, we just emoji it, and now it's added as a subtask. And at some point, somebody will go through all of the subtasks that have been created and say, well, these are the ones that we do need to get done for the beta release, and these are the ones that we can kick to GA, and this is the one that we can kick to the next version of the product whenever we do that. And so all of that is consolidated in one place. It's also important that everybody else who's paying attention to this Slack channel, but might not be actively engineering the work, knows how it's going and can keep tabs on things. So as an engineer begins work on something, they'll probably create a feature flag that's off, that houses whatever they're working on. But every time that feature flag's state changes, there's a notification pinged into that T channel specifically with the new value of the flag and which customer it was changed for. And so it's really exciting to see as a project is entering GA stage, as the product manager, AJ is going through different customers that have signed on to be design partners who are really eager. And we see, okay, it was just turned on for Spotify, or it was just turned on for another customer. That's really galvanizing for anybody who's looking at that channel, because it's just constant progress and velocity towards that goal. And so everything from connecting the work itself to a Slack channel, feature flag that's associated with that work, subtasks that emerge while you're discussing the work in Slack. If the target dates for any of the subtasks change, there's a ping about that in the channel. When a task is completed, that pings, and these automatic robot pings saying a task was completed will get tons of emojis just reacting to them, like fireball or thumbs ups or whatever. So it's like just fun to see that activity coming through. And so I think that's really what we've zeroed in on, is organize work around a Slack channel because that's where the work happens, and then connect all of the operations that you can to that Slack channel to create visibility of progress and velocity and energy.
I can understand why and how all of that activity would create excitement, create energy, and be such a positive force. It also sounds like it creates an immense amount of activity in Slack, like way more than the average company would expect. And so how do you balance digesting the deluge of information that's being created by this with actually having time to do the work?
So there's two answers to that. The first is that everyone is responsible for managing their notifications. And some people, like myself, for example, because of my role at the company, I want every ping, and I even ask for the unread notification to show up if there are messages deep inside a thread that I'm not even subscribed to. Like if there's a thread with other people and they're talking about stuff, for channels of my choosing, I just want all of those notifications. And on the opposite side of the fence, there are engineers who might want to go into like gremlin mode and just ignore the world around them while they just finish a task. They might have the exact opposite, where they're muting, leaving channels, what have you. So the standing principle is you don't ever need to have a particular notification setting, but you can trust that if you're needed, you'll get that mentioned.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Well, yeah, Sumeet, we're coming up on time. And so I have a couple of rapid fire questions. I don't know if we'll get to more than just one of them, but I'm curious, what's your favorite piece of gear that makes working remotely better?
There's two that come to mind. One is my AirNet 4 CO2 air quality monitor, which I keep near my desk. And I don't know if this is placebo effect or not, but I genuinely believe that when I've got fresh air in here with the window open, I'm better. This is something that one of our founders pushes pretty hard. So we actually send every employee, as when they join the company, one of these monitors. And I know that a couple people have traveled with them. So it's like, if you're going to a company retreat, you can take your monitor. If you're going anywhere else, you can do it. But I love having mine, and I just kind of glanced at it. It's at 1410 right now, which is in the red, but that's because I closed all the windows in anticipation of the call. So that's one. The other is I have it's from UG Monk. It's like a designer wooden carved task holder. I guess for people who are watching this, they can see like it's just this like wooden thing, and then this task card slips into it. And so written on the face of this card are all of the things that I want to get done today. And I like it because I like sort of special energy around mundane things. So at the beginning of my day, I write down what I'm trying to finish. And I like the pen that I write with. I like the cards that I'm writing these on. And this silly thing that I could just invent myself for probably 50 cents. Instead, it's this expensive looking and feeling wooden block that shows my card to me. And I don't think I could use that if I were in an office because I'd be bouncing around again. But this is here. This is my whole office, my whole world when I'm working. So it's always there telling me, reminding me what to focus on.
Very cool. Well, we'll put links to both pieces of gear in the show notes. And you'd be surprised. I don't have a CO2 monitor at home. One of our founders is big into that too. And we've brought it to in-person events. And you'd be surprised how quickly most conference rooms get in the red.
Yeah.
Like the ventilation, depending on your building, in conference rooms tends to be bad, is my experience. Well, again, Sumeet, I just want to say thank you for being generous with your time and perspective. It was really great to catch up and hear a little bit more about some of the specific practices that Sublime Security and you have adopted and iterated on over the years. If folks want to learn more about you or your work, where would you recommend they go?
I don't think that there's a lot out there. I'm on Twitter at Sumeet Jain, and I've got SumeetJain.com, which is my neglected personal blog/website. So LinkedIn, I'm on there as well. But anybody is always welcome to reach out. We are hiring for engineers. So if you really want to contact me to get to the top of my inbox, you can say I'm an incredible engineer and I'd love to work at Sublime. And that's Sumeet@SublimeSecurity.com.
Very nice. I can dig it. Well, thank you again, Sumeet, for the time. Chat soon.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Jack.
Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode, or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @Tupel on X or visit distributed.fm.